This is the Modern Day Pirates.
Welcome to Do Nothing But Read, the podcast book club, episode 21, Scary Short Stories to Tell in the Dark. On this volume, we talk about World of Warcraft bosses, Playboy scary stories, and is Alfred E. Newman the opposite of reading? From the home of Richard Bong, Wisconsin, I'm Hannah.
And from the home of John Travolta, New Jersey, I'm Brandon.
He was like a fighter pilot in World War II or something, which he has the best Bong. Name ever. His name was Dick Bong.
Dick Bong!
And he was,
oh, that's funny.
Like a
Dick
fighter.
Bong and John Travolta.
They're sort of the same person.
Yes, so many. We've got more Booktober to talk about.
Booktober. Yeah, Booktober is pretty much the best month of the year.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So, let's get started.
Will do. So, for chapter one today, we're going to talk about scary short stories. Now, we all know, well, anyone who listens to this, knows that I really, really like short stories. Like, more than I like most other forms of anything. Partially because they're like little encapsulated worlds. I don't know. They're just, you can do so much with a short story that I think you can't do with a longer novel. And we've talked about this. But We decided that for this week, for Booktober, that we were going to talk about scary short stories. Particularly two short stories. We each have one that affected us in a very spooky way and that means something to us. Yep. So, Brandon, yours is very iconic, so you should go first.
For my short story for the 2010 Booktober, I'm going to talk about The Legend of Sleepy Hollow by Washington Irving, written in 1820, if you can believe it. Now, Legend of Sleepy Hollow, when I was a kid, I really, really loved the story. Mm-hmm. I had a couple like different kids' books that were adaptions of it. You know, Washington Irving is perhaps like the first world-renowned American writer.
Mm-hmm.
He was born the year that the American Revolution ended.
Oh, wow.
So he really was like, he broke out worldwide. And his stories primarily focus in the Hudson River Valley of New York State.
Mm-hmm.
He falls firmly in the romantic era, and he was very aware that he was a romanticist. He was friends with Mary Shelley, wrote Frankenstein, and I think he visited her in Europe. He traveled a lot around the world. He became famous while he was alive, which not many
nice
writers experienced. So he wrote The Legend of Sleepy Hollow in 1820. And he based it on an old German legend.
Ooh.
And it's a long short story. It's almost a novella. You can buy it as it's usually with like Rip Van Winkle and a couple of his other iconic Hudson River stories. Because it's not enough to really, you know, sell on itself.
Right.
It was originally published in a collection. It has a lot true that a lot of his short stories have where he lived in Tarrytown, and so it's about that area, and it's about the legends that he had heard living in that area. It really grew into be one of the most popular and widely known short stories of all time. Everyone at least knows the basics of this story.
Right.
I don't know how many people have read the original version, because it's been adapted so many times. Like I said, when I was a kid, I had a couple different kids' books versions of it. You know, it's been a Disney animation. It's been...
Oh, I like the Disney one. The Johnny Depp movie. Oof.
There's the Tim Burton version. It's been adapted in many, many ways, and I'd really count The Headless Horseman among the classic horror movie, horror monsters, you know.
Yeah.
And because he was written in the 1800s right with Dracula and Frankenstein. You know, he's with them. He might not have made as much money
as all of those,
but he pops up every time you talk about Halloween.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
The Headless Horseman, he's in there. Like in World of Warcraft, the big quest for Halloween is beating the Headless Horseman.
That's awesome.
Sleepy Hollow, actually, just the town was known as North Tarrytown, and then in 1997, it switched its name back to Sleepy Hollow.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's kind of become like the Halloween capital of the world, I think they call itself that. And their high school team mascot is the Headless Horseman. It's called the Horseman. But, you know, I picked this today because last weekend, my family and I traveled to Sleepy Hollow, New York. I live, and Amanda grew up not far at all from where this story takes place.
Yeah, like, you could drive there. How long of a drive it is?
You could bike there. It's really not that far at all.
It's not far at all.
It's like 15, 20 minutes. Yeah. Right across the Tappan Zee Bridge.
It's so pretty there, too.
The Hudson River Valley is one of the most brilliant, beautiful places on Earth.
It's gorgeous.
And it makes sense that it inspired Washington Irving to write these stories. Because when you're there, when you're in Sleepy Hollow, it's just amazing how well he described the story. Even today, so much of the stuff talked about in the story has survived.
Yeah.
So, like, when you're there, you get the same feeling. You could understand him feeling, because it's right on the river, and in the autumn, it's just beautiful colors of all the trees. It's just a quiet little village, even today. He describes of this this atmosphere, and you know, I reread it today in the original story, outside on my porch in the autumn air, you know, and not far from the area where it all takes place. It was a real like a magical reading experience.
Oh, that's wonderful.
He writes like a romanticist, so 80 to 90% of this story is description of the town. Of the valley itself. Like, he spends more time talking about roads and trees and rivers than he does the characters. But it sets the mood so that when the action at the end happens, like, you have it perfectly in your head. And that's why when you go to visit Sleepy Hollow, it's like, it's so vivid in your mind. Like, 'cause it's just like all this stuff is like, it actually exists as you saw it in your head because the descriptions are so perfect. It's got this awesome structure. Where, let me get this right, it's a story within a story within a story within a story.
They liked doing that, didn't they, back in the day?
Yes, they did. Because it's Ichabod listens to a story, and it's the story of him listening to this story being told by a guy who listened to a story inside of a collection of stories that were made in a pseudonym by Washington Irving to be like one big story. And I know it's very confusing, but that's the layers that this has.
Well, because it was, you know, people would, that's when people still told stories to each other, like around like the fire at night and stuff. So that makes sense.
And that's what the whole story is about, is this guy who's listened to too many horror stories around the fire, and it freaks him out. You think about this time period, this is a very indicative of this whole time period, is that the reason why these writers had to be so detail oriented when it came to describing the areas, because people didn't, there's no pictures of anywhere, like not even pictures in the book, like no one had really pictures, so like you didn't know what an area looked like. We've all seen the pyramid in pictures. No, we've all been there.
I've all seen it.
I know you have. We take for granted that we would have an idea of what someplace looks because we've seen 1,000 pictures. Like, these people had none of that. And they didn't get to travel. So stories were really like travel blogs. They were so obsessed with location because these people didn't get to go anywhere.
I've never really thought about that before.
Yeah. And that's why the 1800s, these novels get so almost to a fault, get so caught up in the atmosphere. And what I also found interesting about this book is that the narrator is intensely aware of himself. And I never realized that when I was a kid, mostly because I was reading, you know, illustrated versions of this. But the narrator knows that he's telling a story to a reader. My brother was just, we were both reading it, and he loved this part where the narrator's talking about the feast at the party, and he goes on for a paragraph about the different types of cakes and pies, and then he's like, I'm going to stop myself now before I talk too much about the cakes and pies so I can get on to the actual story that's at hand. And there's like another moment where he's like, because I'm a romantic writer, I think it's time that I describe how Ichabod looks upon his horse. And then he spends like a whole paragraph describing, but he knows, like, oh, because I'm writing in this style, I'm going to have to tell you what he looks like.
Yeah.
And I think the versions of this story play up, the modern versions of the story play a little too much on the scary side of it. Although the end, at the time, I bet you if you read this, you were pretty frightened.
Oh, we're yeah.
desensitized because we watch movies where people get literally torn to shreds.
Yeah.
But at the time, these ghost stories were scary because this is something you grew up listening to.
Yeah.
These kind of ghost stories.
And you know, if you lived in a small village like that, like in the middle of kind of nowhere, like yeah. you would come across dark bridges in the middle of the woods and mm-hmm. get freaked out then thereafter after reading a story.
Yeah. And I think that's why I really love these old tall tales.
Yeah.
All the 1800s horror, and that's why I keep going back to them again and again,
mm-hmm.
is that this was a time where these people very well thought that this stuff could exist. I love horror and everything, but, mm-hmm. you know, in the back of my mind, I am a skeptic, and we're all skeptics now when you think about ghosts and
yeah.
and monsters and everything. Like, I want to believe. thank you, X-Files. But I do believe in a lot of stuff, but we're a little more skeptical. At that time, these people thought, like, there's no question about it. There's monsters out there.
Right.
So these scary stories, they didn't have to go that graphic because in the people's heads alone, that was enough to scare them. You know?
Yeah.
Because they thought this stuff existed.
Right.
And one thing, too, is that I think going back and rereading it, because I've heard this story again and again and again, but going back and rereading it, I discovered that, and on this rereading, that Ichabod is such a fascinating, iconic character. Like,
mm-hmm.
he's been drawn again and again and again and again.
Yeah.
So we all have a look of how he's supposed to
yeah.
be. But personality-wise, he's more of a douche than I remember him as.
He is. Yeah, he definitely is not a likable character.
He's not. So... When at the end, all of it happens to him, when he, you know, he may or may not have died.
Yeah.
You don't really feel that awful because it's
right.
like there's a story, you know, the story of him courting the girl and
mm-hmm.
Brom Bones being his rival.
Van Tassel. Yeah.
And I think in the kids' versions, they play it up as like a bully kind
yeah.
of situation, but it really was two equally awful men fighting over a woman.
Yeah.
Like, he would purposely give her more singing lessons than the normal people
yeah.
because he was trying to court her. And he saw her father's lands as money. Like, I think there's a part where it says he didn't fall in love with her until he saw how big her father's farm was.
Oh, Ichabod.
Yeah, so, you know, it's more of this, like, time period stuff. Right?
Yeah.
And there is some treatment of African Americans, which might
yeah.
not have be seen as kosher today, but you know that's just the
yeah.
time period.
And he's the kind of character though, where like you know, there's no one named Ichabod now, and people
no.
if you know someone in real life named Ichabod, like I don't even want to know where they're from, but or who their parents were. But if you just say the word Ichabod or Ichabod Crane, like most people know who that is or what that
yeah.
refers to.
That's what I think is so amazing about this. It's just a short story. It's barely a book, written in 1820 by a guy living 20 minutes from where we live.
Yeah.
And it is transcended time to such a level. You know, you think Halloween and you think Sleepy Hollow.
Agreed.
And I think that's incredible.
That's awesome. Well,
so what did you have for us?
I tend to like stories from the 1970s, like, and onward, mm-hmm. I think. 1940s through like the mid 70s is like the era of storytelling that I tend to like a lot. And so I chose Button Button by Richard Matheson, which was published in 1970 in Playboy. And it was made into a terrible movie with way too much plot last year. But Playboy had more at the time in 1970, a reputation of publishing really good horror fiction. So this story is, Richard Matheson wrote I Am Legend and a bunch of other things that you know what they are. You just don't know it's Richard
mm-hmm.
Matheson.
A lot of things have been adapted off of him
yeah,
and not
right.
really attributed to him.
Right.
Like
Where Dreams May Come,
Yeah.
Was his, a bunch of other stuff.
But Button Button turned into, what was the name of the movie?
The Box.
Which had a button in it.
That was pretty much it.
And that's where they stopped.
Yeah. But, so the basic premise of this story was there's a couple, Norma and Arthur. Like, how old-timey and wonderful are those names? They live in New York City. They have no children. They seem kind of like they're older-ish. I don't think he exactly says how old they are, but maybe it's just their names partially, and also because it's an older story, and so even young people tended to act a little older then, I think. But Norma is contacted by this guy who leaves his card outside her house and phones her and all this stuff, and he eventually comes to meet her, and he offers her $50,000, which now is a lot of money. Then was like a lot of money in 1970.
Yeah.
And he offers her $50,000 just to simply push a button that's in a box that he has. And the man, she's like, well, what's the catch? Because obviously I'm not just going to push a button and you're going to give me money. That's too good to be true. And he said, well, there is sort of a catch. If you press this button, someone that you do not know will die. Someone in the entire world, the whole world, someone will die. Right. And Norma's really tempted because it's $50,000. And so
people die all the time.
Right. And people die all the time. And it could be, you know, she even thinks like it could be some poor child in like a village in Africa. And like, you know, maybe like they would have died anyway. Or maybe, you know, maybe it'll be someone who will die anyway. It'll be like a merciful. So she talks it over with her husband. And her husband's like, that's crap. Like, I don't understand. Pushing a button here in New York is not going to make someone around the world die. That's not possible. And like, you know, $50,000, whatever. And so she is not going to do it. But then she changes her mind because the guy comes back and sort of tempts her again. So I don't want to spoil the ending to the story, but I kind of need to talk about it in order for this whole discussion to make sense. So maybe skip ahead first if you don't want spoilers, maybe, perhaps. Because this is the kind of story where you got to talk about it with people. So if you don't want to hear the end of the story, skip ahead like a minute and a half. Okay, so Norma presses the button, and she's like, well, that was easy. And because he leaves the box for her, so she presses it in her own time and closes the box and is like, okay, well, she was expecting like fireworks or something to happen. And then she gets a phone call, and it's someone telling her that her husband had been in a subway accident and that he died. And then the insurance people call and tell her that he had a $50,000 life insurance policy. And then the phone rings again, and she's, you know, distraught. The phone rings again, she answers the phone, and it's the man who'd given her the box. And she said, you told me it wouldn't be someone that I knew. And he says, Norma, did you really think you knew your husband? Doesn't that just make your skin fall off your body? Oh, yeah, my God.
I don't know. It's kind of corny.
No, it's kind of corny, but, like, the first time I read the story, I seriously was like, what the hell? And, like, dropped the book and, like, ran away. Because to me, it's, like, that's the kind of, like, you know, in 1970, that was still fairly, like, fresh and new and, like, a fresh idea. And it's also based on the story, classic story of the monkey's paw, where, you know, where, like, the family, they get this monkey's paw and it's bad luck. They make three wishes. And they wish for a certain amount of money, and then they get a phone call that their son died in an accident, and so they got the money from his accident thing. I forget, their first wish was something else. And then
It's a Simpsons Treehouse of Horrors.
Right, and then, you know, and then then they wish that their son would come back to life.
Yeah.
And then he comes back as a zombie, and then, and then they use their third wish to make him go away. So it's this story is scary to me because it's a different kind of horror story. Like, I like stories where they're
Twilight Zone.
Made it into a Twilight Zone episode in 1986. But I like stories where there are mysterious creatures in the night. But the scariest things to me, and I've definitely said this before on here, probably the last episode, the things that are scariest to me are the things that do not have an explanation for what they do, and the things that, like, no one knows. Like, who is this guy with the box? Is he the devil? I don't know. Like. Yeah. It's that kind of stuff is the stuff that scares me the most.
It's Twilight Zone. It exists. It's not It's in a realm of sci-fi horror.
Yeah.
Maybe we can explore this in another episode entirely, but, you know, you've got the classic ideas of horror, as I've already talked about, you know. We've talked about it in depth, of the gothic horror.
Right.
That has led to a whole slew of stuff. But then there's the sci-fi horror, the Rod Sterling, and that kind of came around in the 50s.
Right. I think that's the kind of stuff that I am the most drawn to. So we have we have different – that's good. We should do another episode about that.
No, I love it too. Believe me, I love it all. Yeah. I love Rod Sterling to death.
Oh, I know.
And this is just something that we haven't got to because I've just had other – you know, we started from the beginning and now we're kind of making our way through time. and believe me, I love Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
Twilight Zone is all, and Outer Limits were all based on short stories.
Which is why I love them.
And adapted into fuller, fuller stories. So, you know, I'm not saying I don't love these things. I love them to death. It's just a completely different genre entirely. It's still horror. Different. It's just more horror of the unknown.
Exactly.
Because, you know, supernatural stuff, you know, it's magic. It's it's fantasy.
Right.
This isn't fantasy. This is science fiction.
Right.
They're both horror. They're just...
Oh, that's a really good way of looking at it.
Yeah. You have to look at gothic horror as fantasy and 50s, 60s horror as more sci-fi.
Well, that's it. I learned something just now.
Yeah. This, like I said before, and maybe this has proved it, I read a ton of science fiction.
Yes, you do. Well, in Chapter 2 every week, we talk about WTF are we reading. So, Brandon, WTF are you reading?
So, I reread Sleepy Hollow, and I attended Comic-Con last weekend. So, I had a lot of comic-y things to read, so that's what I've been going at.
I'm still reading The Amber Spyglass. It's a really meaty book. And I just wanted to say this just because I love this book so much, that my favorite part of this trilogy and this book in particular is that it's intended for young adults, but an author wrote the fact that Philip Pullman wrote this trilogy with the intention of giving it to young adults, and it's intense and profound and meaningful and philosophical and theological and wonderful, like, just, I don't know, the fact that it's so, like, in depth and meaty, but it's into teenagers, like, makes me really, really happy.
Cool. Yeah, that's great to see them getting quality.
Me too. Young adult. Book news.
So, book news, as I just said, New York Comic Con was last weekend, and the Modern Day Pirates, we were there, well, two of us were there, have a lot of posts up on themoderndaypirates.com. about Comic-Con, but there's even more coming. We've just spread them out because we've had so much stuff to write about, so we've just been kind of putting one or two out a day. Some of the big announcements that are book related are mostly comic, although there was a lot of books, that a lot of book publishers are there. Comic-Con covers everything.
Yeah, they do.
It's not just comics anymore. Some of the bigger announcements I think were interesting, considering what we've been talking about lately, is DC and Marvel are both rolling the price of comics, the print comics, back to $2.99.
Ooh.
Because they've been kind of creeping up into the $3.99, $4.99 territory in the last couple of years, which has drawn like a lot of people away. Because I go to the comic book store and I usually only want to spend about $10 when I'm there. Although I see people drop, you know, hundreds of dollars.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, I go to Midtown Comics in Manhattan. That's where I get comics. And I've seen people burn $500 on just paper comics.
Wow.
Yeah. But this could be in relation... this could be because the sale of digital comics is up 1,000%.
What?
In 2010.
Yes. Like, literally 1,000%? Like, that's not an exaggeration?
1,000. Not a typo. It's
holy
up 1,000%.
Bananas. That's awesome.
Yeah, well, because they're just so... I think this has to be attributed to the iPad.
Oh, definitely.
Because with 8 million people with iPads and the comics looking freaking gorgeous on there, comics are just such a perfect type of storytelling for the screen. And that's why I love webcomics, and that's why it's great to see a lot of webcomics breaking out and making money, because it gives everyone a chance to kind of get their stuff seen. But 1,000%, that's massive.
That is massive.
I went to a Mad Magazine panel. That was the highlight of the trip.
Yeah.
And it made me kind of sad too, because these were like, it was like 10 guys and they have been on Mad forever. Mm-hmm. And these are guys that were like, they created comedy in comic form, basically. Mm-hmm. These guys, because you're talking like 50s and 60s, these guys started, right?
Yeah.
So everything that's come out of Mad, these guys have touched. The one guy I got to shake his hand, Dick DiBartolo, he's written in 400 consecutive Mads.
Oh my God.
So chances are, if you can remember a Mad bit, he could have most likely wrote it.
Wow.
And like, they had the guy. These guys are legends, and their panel was empty seats. Let me put it that way.
Aww.
And they were in a smaller hall. And compare that to like the Robot Chicken panel, where people were waiting in line at 2 p.m. for a 4 o'clock panel.
Wow.
You know, it bothers me that people are that ignorant of, like, legends, you know?
Yeah. That is frustrating.
It bothers me. But I found it amazing and inspiring. There's a new Mad Magazine cartoon show on Cartoon Network.
Oh, cool.
The announcement. So, sort of book. It's reading related enough. Although
yeah, whatever.
Probably a lot of people used to think of Mad Magazine as the anti-reading.
Hey, if your eyes are looking at words, you're reading.
Yes.
Well, my book news, you know that, so the National Book Awards were announced, the finalists for the National Book Awards were announced today. And Jonathan Franzen, whose book Freedom we talked about a little bit ago and why we didn't really want to read it, he was not selected as a finalist for the National Book Awards. And people are like flipping out about it. Like, instead of, you know, all these book bloggers and book people online talking about who was selected and, you know, look at this great book that was selected as a finalist. Like, let's talk about them and their accomplishments. Everyone is talking about why was Jonathan Franzen not on this list? So, like, even the articles that are about, like, yay, finalists are also sort of like, but where's Jonathan? And so it's, like, really frustrating because it's overshadowing the people who actually became a finalist. And I realized that I just did the same exact thing because I didn't even name any of them because, like, I don't know any of them. But
weird.
Congrats, finalists, and it's okay. It's okay that Jonathan Franzen is not on this list.
Nice. All right, so thanks for listening to this episode of Do Nothing But Read. For more of this show and general geekery, check out themoderndaypirates.com. And while you're there, you can find all the books, or all the short stories mentioned in this episode. And if you buy them through those links, it'll help us out. You can subscribe to this show on iTunes, and while you're there, give us a rating. That'd be awesome. For more of Amanda's book reviews and views, go to dnbrd.org. You can follow me on Twitter and Goodreads at BB Werner.
And you can follow me on Twitter and Goodreads at Epistemophilia, spelled EPISTEMOPHILIA. Happy reading!